Welcome to the deep dive. I want you to think about the last time you were up at like 2 a.m., right? Just doing maybe 90% of the work on a project.
Oh, I know that feeling.
Yeah, and you find yourself just staring at your screen, wondering why literally absolutely no one else on the team is panicking.
Right. Yeah. It's a completely universal experience. And honestly, it is usually a really harsh wake-up call about who is actually driving the outcomes in your life.
Which, you know, whether you want to admit it or not, is kind of the reality.
Yeah.
And that wake-up call is our mission for today. We are exploring Chapter 10 of Jack Spirko's book.
Laws of Life, Book One.
Exactly. Ditch the System, Design Your Life. And the title of this chapter is actually the exact law we are analyzing today.
Which is, when it comes to what you want and those you love, no one will ever care as much or work as hard as you.
Yep. And, you know, I'm filtering this through my own background. I'm a former operations executive leadership coach. So I've spent years studying how informal authority forms, how teams take ownership, and how careers actually grow when people just stop waiting for permission.
And I'm looking at this from, well, kind of the other side of the spectrum. My background is in family preparedness.
Right, the personal responsibility side.
Exactly. I spend my time helping households take their core values and turn them into practical life plans, evacuation plans, safety, all of that.
So today, we're really blending those two worlds together.
Breaking down how this one single law applies across like your professional ambitions, but also your most deeply personal family obligations.
And we should probably establish right away, the author isn't presenting this as some cynical statement.
No, not
It, because it's easy to hear that title and think, oh, he's just bitter toward the world, right? Assuming everyone else is just lazy.
yeah, like a victim mentality.
Right, but it's not that at all. It is a foundational principle of responsibility. And Jack, the author, he learned this the really hard way in the business
Oh,
world.
yeah, the partnership stories.
Yes. So when he first found real financial success, he had this overwhelming desire to give back. He had endless ideas for businesses, but, you know, zero time to actually run them.
Right. So he found these young, hungry people and just offered them
And
partnerships.
incredibly generous partnerships, too. I mean, he took almost no revenue.
He used his own established platform to push like massive traffic to them.
Yep, offered his full operational support. His only real expectation was that they had to build the actual functional business and, well, match his own relentless work ethic.
Which sounds great on paper.
Right. Putting my leadership coaching hat on for a second, providing resources and a clear runway, that's usually seen as the gold standard of mentorship.
Is, yeah.
Like, if you remove the hurdles, shouldn't a young, hungry entrepreneur just absolutely thrive? Why did almost all of these dozen partnerships completely blow up in his face?
Well, because removing the hurdles removes the friction, and
Right.
friction is required to build grit. Jack expected these partners to have the exact same fire he had when he was, young and broke, but he was essentially handing them unearned equity.
Wow, yeah. Unearned equity.
In an outcome they just hadn't suffered for at all. The psychology here is critical, right? People value what they build, not what they are handed.
That makes so much sense.
The partners didn't want success for themselves as much as Jack wanted it for them, so when the inevitable business problems popped up, they just folded.
That tracks perfectly from an operations standpoint. It's like trying to push a parked car versus steering a rolling one.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Right. You can help guide a rolling car, and you can definitely give it a push down a hill to speed it up, but you cannot supply the engine's torque for someone else's parked car.
You really can't.
So Jack realized later he should have challenged these people to build a functional baseline business completely on their own for a full year before he ever offered a dime of help.
And that completely redefines how we view fairness. Well, we're conditioned by society to think that making the starting line like fair or easy for a beginner is the moral thing to do.
Oh, right.
But if they had built that business alone first, they would have proven their own internal drive. By trying to make it easy, Jack actually robbed them of the resilience they needed to survive later.
So teaching people that working harder for less at the start isn't fair, that's really just a mechanism for training people to settle for average.
Exactly. But if you decide you aren't going to settle for average, if you decide to just carry the load yourself, the dynamic completely changes.
You start accumulating informal influence.
Yes. And Jack shares this brilliant story from his mid-20s. He was a hotshot salesperson making six figures.
Literally saving jobs at his company, right?
Yeah, writing $2.5 million in business in his first 7 months. And he figures out this loophole.
Oh, okay. I love a good loophole.
If a construction project comes in under budget, his commissions go up. So he starts pulling $100 bills out of his own pocket.
Out of his own pocket.
His own pocket.
All right.
And giving them to the project managers so they can buy their crews drinks after work.
Okay, wait. Let me stop you there. Because if I'm running operations and one of my salespeople is walking the floor handing out cash to project managers out of his own pocket, I am immediately calling HR.
Oh, absolutely. It looks terrible.
It sounds like bribery, or at least a massive failure of management. Why didn't he just submit a budget request to the company to fund a morale boost?
Because submitting a budget request subjects you to corporate bureaucracy, which, as you know, kills momentum.
Fair point.
But more importantly, from a psychological perspective, using his own money is exactly why it worked.
Oh, really?
It demonstrated personal skin in the game. When he handed over his own cash, it triggered this deep psychological mechanism of reciprocity.
Right, because it wasn't faceless corporate money.
Exactly, it was Jack's money. So without even realizing it, the project managers, the operations manager, the purchasing manager, they all started looking at Jack as the actual leader of the company.
Because he was the one personally investing in their success.
Yep. And that informal authority became a massive, tangible problem during a company-wide software migration.
Oh, man. Software migrations. Everyone always hates the new software.
Everyone hated it. Jack was smart enough to master it in a few days, but he hated it, too. And because he was this loud, charismatic guy, his complaints to his manager were echoing down the halls.
So the staff's mentality became, if Jack says this software sucks, then it sucks.
Right. His influence was so strong, it was causing a localized mutiny, which leads to this fascinating intervention with a higher-level mentor named Ron.
Tell me about Ron.
So Ron pulls Jack into a meeting room and just lays it out perfectly. He says, I have a coup d'etat on my hands, and you are leading it without even knowing it.
Wow.
Ron explains exactly what informal authority is.
Mm-hmm.
He shows Jack that because Jack cared the most and worked the hardest, everyone was following his lead.
Even his negative lead.
Exactly. So instead of pulling rank or firing him, Ron asks for his help. He asks Jack to stop troubleshooting out loud and to write a user guide to save the entire migration.
That is incredible leadership from Ron, honestly.
It really is.
Yeah.
And it illustrates the mechanism of outworking your environment. When you are the person who always does more, you learn incredibly fast.
But the inevitable result is that you hit a ceiling, right?
Yep. Jack fixed the software issue, but soon after, the company capped his earnings.
That is the danger of outworking a limited system. You just bump your head.
Exactly.
So Jack introduces this philosophy, and it really echoes Robert Kiyosaki that you never take a job for what it pays you. You take it for what it can teach you.
Moving up and moving over.
Right. When his learning and earning hit that ceiling, he left for a regional management job. Didn't pay much more, but it taught him how to run a P&L and how to manage a territory.
He contrasts taking a job for its practical education against the modern trap of students taking on, you know, six figures of debt for a degree that is functionally useless.
Because society constantly sells this narrative that an education is priceless.
Right. But the hard truth is, an education is only priceless if it's directly relevant to your life goals.
Otherwise, it's just a financial anchor. I see this all the time in coaching, honestly. Society conditions us to think that doing extra work without immediate financial reward means you are getting taken advantage of.
Oh, totally.
But the reality is, doing more than you're paid for is an unfair advantage. It is exactly how you purchase informal authority and get a rapid real-world education.
But, you know, we have to recognize that the hustle, the professional drive, it's all a means to an end.
To take care of our families.
Exactly. We push ourselves professionally for them. But the text makes a really crucial pivot here, noting that earning money is only the absolute baseline of family responsibility.
So how does this law apply to the personal side, the those you love part of the equation?
Well, it means applying the exact same intensity and intentionality to your home life that you apply to your career.
Okay, that makes sense.
Jack shares this profound realization he had about his calendar. He noticed that if a 5 p.m. meeting with a New York consultant was on his calendar, it was just written in stone.
Short of a medical emergency, he was going to be there.
Right. But his wife and son did not have that same guaranteed block of protected time.
So he started physically putting date nights on his professional calendar.
He did. And his wife's initial reaction is so relatable, she hated it.
She felt it was clinical.
Yeah, her argument was, you shouldn't have to schedule me if I'm important.
But his framing of it changes everything.
It really does. He asked her, Are you more important than a client or an employee? And she said yes.
So he replied, then if they get a guaranteed spot on my calendar, why shouldn't you?
Exactly. It shifted the schedule from feeling like a chore to being the ultimate demonstration of priority.
I love that. It really bridges the gap between executive function and emotional connection.
Yeah.
But, you know, the book takes a much sharper, harder turn when discussing keeping the family safe.
Oh, yeah.
And this is exactly your domain.
It is, yeah. The chapter challenges a very common societal narrative, this idea that it is the government's job to keep us safe. The author argues that government systems can offer a deterrent, but they cannot prevent a determined threat or a random accident.
Because the biological reality is that no government agency, no teacher, and no doctor will ever care about your family's safety and future as much as you do.
He uses first responders as a pretty brutal example.
I remember this part. During a major disaster, first responders spend the first 72 hours just setting up logistics.
Right. Staging areas, chain of command. They aren't executing immediate rescues.
Because their operational credo is dead rescuers save no lives.
And strategically, that is completely logical for them. They have to protect their assets. But if your family is trapped, you cannot rely on a system that is fundamentally designed to prioritize its own operational safety over your immediate emergency.
He applies the same logic to ER doctors, too.
He does. An ER doctor will fight like absolute hell to save your life. But if they lose you on the operating table, they will feel a moment of professional sadness, and then they just have to move on to the next patient.
That isn't cruel. It is just biological and professional reality. Mm-hmm. Before you are even buried, they will have moved on.
Exactly. And the author extends this to health and education. Your health is your responsibility, well beyond what a doctor prescribes. Your child's education is your responsibility, well beyond state-sanctioned homework.
Which leads to an observation the author makes about modern safety nets that I find fascinating.
Oh, the poverty and obesity connection.
Yes. He notes that modern society has created so many safety nets that it breeds a false sense of security, leading to a situation where poverty and obesity are often linked in America.
And to be clear, we are just conveying the author's observation on societal systems here.
Right. Absolutely. He's pointing out that society has made anything short of actual death something you can survive in relative comfort.
Yeah. If you lose a house, there's a cot and a shelter.
If a student gets C+ grades, the system will still push them into a college and saddle them with debt.
If you develop lifestyle-induced diabetes, the medical system will provide a pill so you can keep eating poorly without immediately dying.
It provides minimum comfort.
But the vital question the author asks is minimum comfort propped up by a bureaucratic system that doesn't actually care about you, what you really want for your family?
Which forces me to ask, why does a person willingly work 100-hour weeks to provide financially, but absolutely refuse to spend one single hour making a home evacuation plan or storing a few weeks of extra food?
It all comes down to the neurology of complacency. When survival pressure is removed by a visible safety net, the brain's sense of urgency completely dies.
Oh, interesting.
It is incredibly easy to say, I love my children, while running up credit card debt and living paycheck to paycheck without a backup plan. But true love requires action beyond just clocking into a job.
But if we know this intuitively, if we know deep down that no one is coming to save us, why is it so incredibly hard to actually act on it?
The author identifies the friction here as cognitive dissonance.
Right.
And he defines it in this context as the physiological stress that occurs when your daily behaviors run counter to what you fundamentally know to be true.
The brain literally creates a threat response when your beliefs and actions don't match.
Exactly. It's like knowing you have a major presentation due, but you're sitting on the couch watching TV. That nagging feeling in the back of your head makes you snap at your spouse or your kids.
It steals your joy.
Yeah.
In the tech world, we'd compare it to a corrupted background app on your smartphone.
Oh, that's a perfect way to put it.
Right. It's silently draining your battery, it's overheating the processor, and slowing down every other function until the whole system just crashes.
Living in that constant state of low-level stress ruins your health and your relationships.
And the author uses a great analogy of a kid growing over the summer.
Oh, I love this part.
Yeah. When you see your child every single day, you don't notice the millimeter changes.
Mm-hmm.
But a relative who hasn't seen them in 3 months is blown away by how much they've grown.
But when you apply that slow, imperceptible change to ignoring these core responsibilities, it isn't a harmless growth spurt.
No, it is a slow motion train wreck. You don't notice the daily psychological and physical damage until suddenly you wake up at 40 years old, 80 grand in debt, going through a divorce, and heavily medicated.
To combat that dissonance, Jack provides a tactical framework to ensure things actually get done, regardless of who else shows up.
The LOD method.
Yes, LOAD. So the first part is L, look at everything as your responsibility.
Oh, I see people fail at that all the time in corporate environments. People waste so much time trying to figure out whose official job something is.
Right. But if an issue affects the outcome you want, it is your responsibility. You cannot wait for an email assigning you ownership.
Which ties directly into the next piece.
Yeah.
Own the result, not just your role.
The phrase, that's not my job, is the ultimate anthem of the average.
Absolutely. Outcomes simply do not care about your job description. If the project fails or if your family is in danger, it's on you, regardless of what your official role was supposed to be.
And when you own the result, you have to A, act without waiting on others.
Hesitation is exactly where momentum dies. Mm. People wait for permission or they wait for a committee to agree.
But action always beats coordination when everyone else is just standing still.
Finally, D, do more than is required. Doing just enough to not get in trouble is a recipe for complete stagnation.
Yeah, the gap between what is strictly required by the system and what actually achieves incredible results, that gap is where all the opportunity in life lives.
So, look, own, act, do, the LOAD method.
You can apply that to running a team, protecting your family, or navigating student life.
But there is a massive prerequisite to making any of this work, right? You cannot carry the load for your team or your family if the person carrying it, meaning you, is broken.
This brings us to the final and perhaps most vital piece of the chapter, self-love.
The text strongly challenges the bad societal programming we receive that loving yourself is selfish, or that prioritizing your own health is narcissistic.
Narcissism and self-love are complete opposites. Narcissists don't actually love themselves. They secretly loathe themselves and overcompensate by tearing others down.
True self-love means accepting that you are flawed, but valuing yourself anyway. Exactly how you value your spouse or your child despite their flaws.
And the practical reality behind this is stark. Have you ever witnessed someone trying to care for an addict?
Or someone with a serious illness who just refuses to care for themselves?
It is a brutal, soul-crushing experience for the caregiver. By refusing to love yourself and care for your own physical and mental health, you are forcing your family to carry that awful burden.
You are doing the exact opposite of providing for them.
To drive this home, Jack uses this incredible analogy.
Let's find your analogy.
Yes. Imagine you are at a park and your child is in sudden fatal danger. A total stranger leaps in, risks their own life, and saves your child.
They hand your child back to you, completely safe.
In that moment, you would instantly love that stranger with every fiber of your being.
Absolutely. The level of gratitude and love you would feel for them would be immeasurable.
But think about the logic here. Since you would do the exact same thing for your child, you would risk your life for them without a second thought. Aren't you worthy of that exact same love?
It is such a profound shift in perspective. We so easily grant this intense admiration and grace to a hypothetical stranger, but we ruthlessly withhold it from ourselves.
And that lack of self-worth fundamentally weakens our ability to lead and protect our families.
A person who truly loves themselves does not self-destruct. They don't slowly kill themselves with bad habits or stress.
Self-love is the absolute biological prerequisite to survival and to having the capacity to care for others.
We've covered incredibly deep ground today. Let's distill this down to the core practical takeaways from the text.
Okay, so the realities are clear. No one will ever care about your future or your family as much as you do.
No one will work as hard for your success.
Right. Most people do work hard, but they are working hard on their own priorities. Expecting them to match your effort on your goals is a setup for failure.
And finally, truly providing for your family requires far more than just bringing home a paycheck.
It requires taking ultimate, unconditional responsibility for their physical safety, health, and future.
Making this shift, you know, deciding to actually live consistently with this law is gonna suck at first.
Oh, yeah.
If you are buried in debt, paying it off doesn't feel as fun as buying new things. If you're out of shape, the first month of exercising is miserable.
The author compares it to having a surgeon cut a tumor out of your body.
Exactly. The surgery is painful, the recovery is awful, but letting the tumor grow will literally kill you.
The pain of taking responsibility is just the beginning of the cure.
For more resources and to dive deeper into these principles, you should definitely head over to jackslaws.com.
But before we go, I want to leave you with a provocative thought from the text to really mull over.
Let's hear it.
If a complete stranger found your calendar and your bank statements today, with absolute no other context about your life, who would they think you actually care about?
Wow, that is a heavy audit to run on yourself. To help hardwire this mental shift, Jack provides three specific lines of code to rewrite your mental computer. He says to enter these exactly as they are.
Okay.
Computer, if it matters to me, assume I must carry the load.
Yep.
Computer, never expect other people to care about my priorities as much as I do.
That's a big one.
Computer, my family, my future, and my life are my job.
It's all about accepting the reality of the landscape and finding immense power in that acceptance.
So next time you find yourself frustrated that someone else isn't pushing that parked car with you, remember, it's your car.
And the moment you decide to get behind it and push it yourself, that's the moment it actually starts moving.
For more on this, head over to jackslaws.com. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.